Chinese Junk and Chinese Whispers. I wrote the foreword to Sue Blackmore's The Meme Machine and used the occasion to offer an answer to one of the main criticisms of meme theory. The criticism was that memes, unlike genes, don't have high-fidelity replication. As the generations go by, the critic complains, the information will degenerate, a condition fatal to evolution. In DNA, the sequence ATGCGATTC will be precisely copied, or if miscopied, will contain a definite, discreetly identifiable error. But when a meme, such as a nursery rhyme, is copied, say, from father to child, the replication is imprecise, the child's voice is higher, her vowels are not pronounced in exactly the same way, and so on. Therefore, memes are not like genes and can't be the basis for evolution, because the replication fidelity is not high enough. The criticism is superficially plausible but demonstrably wrong. I answered it with a series of thought experiments, versions of the childhood game of Chinese Whispers, telephone to American children. Imagine 20 children in a line. I whisper a sentence to the first child. It might be, "Down in a deep dark dell sat an old cow munching a beanstalk." The first child whispers what she has heard to the second child, and so on down the line. The 20th child then sings out the evolved version of the sentence. It might have become distorted, provoking hilarity. But if the phrase is short, and especially if it means something in the children's own language, there's a good chance that it will survive, intact, to the end of the line. Now, if we take a particular instance of the game where the phrase emerges correctly at the far end of the line, I make the following point. It doesn't matter that each child's vocalization of the phrase is not a precise copy of the preceding child's. One child might have an Irish accent, the next a Scottish accent, the next a Yorkshire accent, and so on. Because the phrase is meaningful to them in their own shared language, each child will normalize it. Scottish vowels are different from Yorkshire vowels, but the difference doesn't detract from the content. An Australian child hears the words, recognizes them as drawn from the shared lexicon of the English language, and correctly renders them in such a way that the next child, with an American accent, say, can understand the phrase and pass it on. There might be a mutation somewhere along the way. For example, say child number 14 changes dark to dank, and the mutant form, dank, is then copied to the end of the line. That would be interesting in itself, but let's take the case where no such mutation occurs. Now suppose that an experimenter with a tape recorder eavesdrops on each whispering child down the line. She separates the 19 recordings as separate little tapes and scrambles them in a hat. Independent observers are then given the tapes and asked to rank them in order of resemblance to the original message as spoken to the first child. You know what the result would be. Assuming no mutations of the dark, dank kind, there will be no tendency for tapes that come from early in the sequence to be better than those that come late. There is no tendency for degeneration as the copying process proceeds. That alone should be enough to confound the criticism I mentioned. But let's take the thought experiment one stage further. Suppose the message is in a language the children do not know. Suppose it is Ama verumque cano, Troiae qui primus aboris. Again, we know what will happen without needing to do the experiment. The children, knowing no Latin, can only imitate phonetically. The final sounds emerging from the 20th child will have lost almost all resemblance to the original sound spoken to the first child. Moreover, if we do the experiment of shuffling the tapes in a hat, once more we know what the result will be. Independent observers will certainly be able to rank the tapes in order of resemblance to the original message. There will be a steady deterioration in resemblance to the original from the first tape to the last. You could do parallel experiments, not with words, but with skills. For example, a skill in carpentry, simulating the transmission from master carpenter to apprentice, and so on through 20 generations. Here, the equivalent of normalization, playing a role equivalent to the shared language, will, I suspect, be an appreciation of what the skill is designed to achieve. If, for instance, the master is teaching the apprentice how to hammer in a nail, the apprentice will probably not imitate the precise number and strength of hammer blows. Rather, he will imitate the goal the master is trying to achieve, namely, head of nail flush with wood. and he'll go on hammering until the goal is achieved. The goal is what he'll imitate, and that is what will be passed on to the next apprentice. In my Blackmore Forward, I used the example of another manual skill, folding paper to make an origami Chinese junk. Its plausibility as a meme is illustrated by the fact that, when I introduced it to my boarding school, it spread like a measles epidemic. Even more interesting, I learned the skill from my father, who had, in his turn, learned it when it spread as an epidemic through the very same school a quarter century earlier. When imitating an origami skill, each child imitates not the exact hand movements of the preceding child, but a normalized version, consisting of a perception of what the preceding child is trying to do. For example, the apprentice child will infer that the teacher child is trying to fold exactly into the middle. If the teacher is clumsy and his fold actually overshoots the midline slightly, the apprentice will ignore the error and try to fold exactly into the midline. And now, the equivalent of the tapes in the hat is to ask independent observers to rank the 19 Chinese junks. Assuming no major mutations, which again would be interesting in their own right, there will be no tendency for junks later in the sequence to show any degeneration compared to junks early in the sequence. There'll be good ones and bad ones dotted around the line because, I strongly suspect, skilled children will not attempt to imitate obvious incompetence, like folding a little way past the midline, but will normalise. There may be good objections to the meme gene analogy, but degeneration because of low fidelity replication is not one of them. If we wanted to perform an experiment in mimetics, what might we do? Perhaps take a word with a conventional pronunciation, invent a mutant mispronunciation, and broadcast it daily to tens of thousands of people, then later investigate whether the mutant pronunciation takes over the meme pool and becomes the norm. An expensive protocol, unlikely to attract funds from a grant-giving agency. Fortunately, however, by sheer happenstance, the expensive part of the experiment is sometimes done for us. Trains of the London Underground system have an onboard tannoy which daily broadcasts to tens of thousands of passengers the names of the stations. The pre-mutant pronunciation of one particular station is Marylebone. The mutant pronunciation on the Bakerloo line, spoken by a young woman's recorded voice, is Marylebone. All that remains for the experiment is to ask a random sample of commuters on the Bakerloo line how they pronounce the name, and repeat the sample at yearly intervals, then investigate the dispersive spread of the meme by sampling the British population as a whole. My guess is that the mutant form has already started to propagate quite widely. I facetiously suggest that the last bastion to fall will be the Marylebone Cricket Club, the famous MCC. Models of the World. Under Horace Barlow's influence, I came to see an animal's sensory systems, especially the set of tuned recognition neurons in the brain, as a kind of model of the world in which the animal lives. In the same vein, I presented the genes of the animal as a digital description of past worlds, a kind of statistical average of the living conditions of the animal's ancestors, environments in which the ancestors had survived. I saw the gene pool of a species as an averaging computer, averaging the properties of ancestral worlds. Similarly, brains, as they learn, average the statistical properties of the world that the individual animal has experienced during its own lifetime. As the sculptor, which is natural selection, chips away at a gene pool, turning it into a descriptive model of averaged ancestral worlds, so individual experience sculpts brain models of the current world. In both cases, the models are updated by data from the world, but on the timescale of generations for the gene pool model, the timescale of individual development for the brain model. I have long liked this poem by Julian Huxley, with whom, for some reason, I identified as an undergraduate, and I quoted it in A Devil's Chaplain. The world of things entered your infant mind to populate that crystal cabinet. Within its walls the strangest partners met, and things turned thoughts did propagate their kind. For, once within, corporeal fact could find a spirit, fact and you in mutual debt built there your little microcosm, which yet had hugest tasks to its small self assigned. Dead men can live there and converse with stars. Equator speaks with pole and night with day. Spirit dissolves the world's material bars. A million isolations burn away. The universe can live and work and plan. At last made God within the mind of man. I would now add another verse in imitation of the Huxley style. Ancestral worlds invade your species' genes, encoding long-forgotten deaths and lives, digital texts enshrining what survives, distilled from genomes now in smithereens. What went before? What happened? Who can say? Yet all is written in your DNA. I encountered Julian Huxley only once when he was old and I was young. The Department of Zoology at Oxford had commissioned a joint portrait of its three elder statesmen, Alistair Hardy, John Baker, and E.B. Ford. Sir Julian was invited to unveil it. As he read out each page of his speech, he put it to the bottom of the pile in his hand. After he read the last sheet and put it to the bottom, he simply started again, reading the top sheet. To the delight of the mischievous students present, he read right through the whole speech twice and was about to embark on a third reading when his wife bustled forward, seized him by the arm, and hustled him off the stage. Reverting to Julian Huxley's poem and the brain models constructed on the timescale of individual development, many of my public lectures during the 1990s were devoted to the theme. I was especially inspired by the virtual reality software to which I was introduced during my Christmas lectures year and which I demonstrated to the children at the Royal Institution. I brought it all together in the chapter of Unweaving the Rainbow called Reweaving the World. When we think we are looking out at the real world, there is a strong sense in which we are looking at a simulation constructed in the brain but constrained by information flowing in from the real world. It is as though the brain contains cupboards full of models waiting to be pulled out at the behest of information flowing in from the sense organs. In a sort of exception that proves the rule sense, visual illusions persuade us of this, as Richard Gregory has shown us in his books and in his Simony lecture in Oxford. The Necker cube is a famous illusion, which I also used in the extended phenotype as an analogy for my two ways of looking at natural selection, the gene's eye view and the vehicle view. It is a two-dimensional pattern which is equally compatible with two alternative three-dimensional models in the cupboard. The brain could have been designed to plump for one of the two models and stick to it. Actually, what it does is take first one model out of the cupboard, see that for a few seconds, then put it back and take the other model out. So what we see is first one cube, then the other, then the first again, and so on. Other famous illusions, such as the devil's tuning fork, see the E-appendix, the impossible triangle, which I demonstrated during my Royal Institution Christmas lectures, and the hollow mask illusion, all make the same point more dramatically. We move through a constructed world, a world of virtual reality. If we are sane, undrugged, and awake, the constructed virtual reality through which we walk is constrained by sense data in ways that conduce to our survival. It is the real world, not a world of dreams or hallucinations in which we must survive. Computer software allows us to walk through imaginary worlds, fantasy worlds, Greek temples or fairylands, science fiction landscapes of alien planets. When we turn our head, accelerometers in the helmet register the movement, and the images the computer presents to our eyes shift in register. We seem to be turning inside the Greek temple and now see a statue that had been behind us. And when we dream at night, the brain's own virtual reality software emancipates itself from reality, and we walk through splendid mansions of the mind or run from constructed monsters in panic-ridden nightmares. In Unweaving the Rainbow, and in my lectures of the 1990s, I fantasized about a surgeon of the future, in a separate room from her patient, walking through his intestine, which is realistically simulated using data from an endoscope inside him. When she turns her head to the side, the tip of the endoscope swings in sympathy. She forges on through the virtual, yet constrained by endoscopic reality, intestine until she locates the tumour ahead of her. She wields the virtual chainsaw in her toolkit, and the appropriate microsurgical blade at the tip of the endoscope mirrors her large arm movements in miniature and delicately cuts out the tumour. A parallel fantasy had a plumber of the future doing the same kind of thing, walking or even swimming down a virtual drain, while his movements are mirrored in the real drain by a small robot deployed to clear a blockage. The key is constraint. The virtual worlds in which we move are not purely fantastic, but guided along tram lines, constrained to be usefully close to reality. Our human mental cupboards are especially well furnished with face models, and we eagerly retrieve them given even the smallest encouragement through our optic nerves. This accounts for the numerous stories of Jesus or the Virgin Mary appearing in a slice of toast or a damp wall. The hollow mask illusion, which also featured in my Christmas lecture, is the most spectacular manifestation of our face-happy model-retrieving facility. It's also significant that there is a named brain deficiency, prosopagnosia, sufferers from which can see normally, except that they can't recognise faces, even faces of people they know well and love. I reprise the theme in The God Delusion, showing how wrong we are to be impressed by visions and apparitions, ghosts and jinns, angels and blessed virgins. Our brains are masters of the art of virtual reality. To knock up a vision of a haloed, glowing, robed figure is child's play, and so is a still small voice in a storm. Many people are sincerely convinced that they have a personal experience of God. He speaks to them, appears to them in dreams and waking reveries. They need to be less impressed. Study Richard Gregory and the psychologists. Recognize the power of illusion. Understand how easily illusion morphs into delusion. God delusion, for example. The argument from personal incredulity. In The Blind Watchmaker, I coined the phrase argument from personal incredulity as a summation of the creationist's principal argument. A less sarcastic rendering would be argument from statistical improbability, or argument from complexity, for statistical improbability is the relevant measure of complexity and the relevant provoker of incredulity. Here's how the argument always goes. A complex biological structure is extolled, having many parts arranged in a precise way. Any random rearrangement of the parts wouldn't work. The number of possible rearrangements is calculated and found, of course, to be astronomically large. Therefore, the complicated arrangement can't have come about by chance. Therefore, here's where the argument shoots itself in the foot. God must have done it. Darwin himself devoted part of a chapter to what he called organs of extreme perfection and complication. He began with a famous sentence, much quoted by creationists. To suppose that the eye, with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration, could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree. You can tell, can't you, from the tone of Darwin's sentence that he wasn't going to leave it there. Doesn't his tone send a clear signal that a but or a yet is about to follow? He might even have been leading his readers on, beckoning them towards him, so that the punch, when it came, had the greater impact. Yet reason tells me that. Google finds a mere 39,300 occurrences of the latter clause, compared to 130,000 for the immediately preceding phrase, absurd in the highest degree. As Darwin himself said elsewhere, great is the power of steady misrepresentation. What's wrong with the argument from statistical improbability, of course, is that natural selection is not a theory of chance. Natural selection is the non-random filtering of random variation, and the reason it works is that the improvement is cumulative and gradual. In The Blind Watchmaker, I illustrated this with the metaphor of a combination lock, for example, guarding the door of a bank vault. In the BBC Horizon film with the same name, I actually hammed up an attempt to open a real bank vault with a random number. The whole point of a combination lock is that you need stupendous luck to break in by random dial twiddling. But if the lock had a fault, such that the vault progressively creaked open another chink every time the number on the dial moved in the right direction, any fool could break in. That's the equivalent of gradualistic natural selection. My later metaphor of Mount Improbable did the same explanatory duty. As briefly mentioned before, when I worked with Russell Barnes on the television film Root of All Evil, we simulated Mount Improbable in the Garden of the Gods at Colorado Springs. I was filmed standing atop a sheer precipice to represent the creationist or huge stroke of luck side of the mountain, where achieving the improbable in a single step is equivalent to leaping from the foot to the summit in a single bound. Then the camera was resighted, and I had to tramp stolidly up the gentle, gradual slope on the evolutionary side of the mountain. No problem evolving organs of limitless complexity, given only enough time and a gentle gradient of improvement, with no sudden leaps. Television being what it is, of course, the gradient and the precipice were actually on different mountains. The Inspector Morse effect, whereby the melancholy inspector is filmed entering one Oxford college and debouching into the quadrangle of another. Of all the many reasons people give for theistic belief, the argument from statistical improbability is the one I meet by far the most often. Frequently, as I said, it goes with a naive mathematical calculation of the stupendous odds against something as complex as an eye or a hemoglobin molecule coming into existence by chance. It also extends to the idea of the Big Bang as the origin of all things. Here are a couple of examples from a Jehovah's Witness pamphlet, and they are entirely typical of the genre. Imagine that someone told you that there was an explosion at a printing plant and that the ink spattered onto the walls and ceilings and formed an unabridged dictionary. Would you believe it? How much more unbelievable is it that everything in the orderly universe came about as a result of a random Big Bang? If you were walking through the forest and discovered a beautiful log cabin, would you think, how fascinating, the trees must have fallen in just the right way to make this house? Of course not, it's just not reasonable. So why should we believe that everything in the universe just happened to come about? I have to confess that this kind of thing frustrates me and sometimes provokes me to an impatience which I, only slightly, regret. This is for three reasons. First, if it were really true that the odds stacked against a naturalistic explanation of apparent design really were monumental on this scale, outnumbering the atoms in the universe, only an equally monumental fool would fall for it. I hate to descend to an argument from authority, but is it too much to ask that this might perhaps arouse a little inkling of a misgiving in the mind of the creationist? Isn't it worth at least a fleeting thought that those who trot out these gigantic improbabilities might just conceivably have missed the point? Scientists get things wrong sometimes. They seldom get things wrong by 80 orders of magnitude. My second reason for irritation is that the argument against blind chance misses so much of real value, mainly the spectacular power and elegance of science, epitomized by Darwin's theory. Supremely powerful yet supremely simple, it really is one of the most beautiful ideas ever to occur to a human mind, and the uninitiated are missing it. Worse, if they thrust their misunderstanding on children, they are denying children that beauty, the beauty of intellectual consummation. And third, the argument from statistical improbability or complexity is irritating because the astronomical odds against complexity arising by blind chance are simply a restatement of the problem that must be solved by any theory of existence, whether it is the Big Bang or evolution or the God theory. Anybody can see that the answer to the riddle of existence cannot be blind chance or sudden springing into existence from nothing. This is especially true in the case of life, because the illusion of design there is so stunningly persuasive. The problem is to find the alternative to blind chance. The improbability of life is precisely the problem we need to solve. The God theory conspicuously doesn't solve it, merely restates it. Natural selection, being gradual and cumulative, solves the problem, and is probably the only process that could solve it. It is clearly futile to try to solve the problem of life's complexity by postulating another complex entity called God. The same applies, albeit less obviously, to the problem of cosmological origins. The more the creationist piles on the statistical improbability, the more he shoots himself in the foot. The God delusion. That point about the statistical improbability of apparent design pervades the blind watchmaker and climbing Mount Improbable, and I nominated it explicitly as the central argument of the God delusion. It is, of course, not original. The publication of the latter book led to a large number of alleged replies to the point about God being complex, and therefore no solution to the riddle of complexity. The replies are all the same, and all equally weak. They can be summed up in one sentence. God is not complex, but simple. How do we know? Because theologians say so, and they're the authorities on God, are they not? Easy. Win the argument by fiat. But you cannot have it both ways. Either God is simple, in which case he doesn't have the knowledge and design skills to provide the explanation of complexity that we seek, or he is complex, in which case he needs explaining in his own right, no less than the complexity that he is being invoked to explain. The simpler you make your God, the less qualified he is to explain the complexity of the world. And the more complex you make him, the more does he require an explanation in his own right. Peter Atkins dramatized the point in his beautifully written Creation Revisited, where he postulated a lazy God, and then, step by step, whittled down what the lazy God would need to do in order to make the universe we see. He concluded that the lazy God would need to do so little he might as well not bother to exist at all. As for granting God the complex supplementary skills he's supposed to deploy, listening to the thoughts of 7 billion people simultaneously, not to mention conversing with dead ones too, answering their prayers, forgiving their sins, meeting out posthumous punishment or reward, saving some cancer patients but not others, that only adds to the problem, and in a big way. Darwinian evolution uniquely solves the problem of life's statistical improbability because it works cumulatively and gradually. It really does broker a legitimate traverse from primordial simplicity to eventual complexity, and it is the only known theory capable of doing so. Human engineers can make complex things by design, but the whole point is that human engineers need to be explained too, and evolution by natural selection explains them at the same time as it explains the rest of life. Of course, there's much more in the God delusion than the central argument about statistical improbability. There are passages on the evolutionary origins of religion, on the roots of morality, on the literary value of religious scriptures, on religious child abuse, and many other things. I like to think it's a humorous and humane book, far from the angry and strident polemic that is sometimes alleged. Some of the humour is satire, even ridicule, and it's true that the targets of such humour often have a hard time distinguishing good-natured ridicule from hate speech. One of the things I learned from Peter Medawar is that precisely aimed satirical ridicule is not the same thing as vulgar abuse. Nevertheless, religiously motivated critics often seem incapable of seeing the difference. One even suspected me of Tourette's syndrome, though it's hard to believe he had read the book. He probably just fell in love with his own simile. Given the level of vitriol visited on this book, it is quite surprising that, in all my hundreds of public appearances, including many in the so-called Bible Belt of the United States, I have hardly ever experienced any heckling of any sort to my face, indeed, scarcely ever been subjected to any critical questioning. This is actually quite a disappointment, for I have found myself enjoying the rare exceptions, in particular the occasion when I was invited to lecture at Randolph Macon Women's College in Virginia. They now take men too. Randolph Macon is a decent liberal arts college with high standards. But Liberty University, founded by the infamous Jerry Falwell, is in the same town, and a substantial busload from Liberty came across and occupied the front row of the lecture theatre at Randolph Macon. They monopolised the question and answer session, lining up in a body behind the microphones in the two aisles. Their questions were courteous to a fault, but all were frankly motivated by fundamentalist Christianity, profession of which is an entrance requirement imposed by that university. I had, of course, no difficulty in disposing of each one in turn, to cheers from the Randolph Macon women. One questioner began by telling us that Liberty University possesses a dinosaur fossil labelled as 3,000 years old. He asked me to explain how they might go about demonstrating the true age of such a fossil. I explained that fossils are dated by several different radioactive clocks running at very different speeds, and all independently agree that dinosaurs are no less than 65 million years old. I added, if it's really true that the Museum of Liberty University has a dinosaur fossil which is labelled as being 3,000 years old, then that is an educational disgrace. It is debauching the whole idea of a university and I would strongly encourage any members of Liberty University who may be here to leave and go to a proper university. That got the biggest cheer of the evening, because Randolph Macon is a proper university. Another of the questions that evening, what if you're wrong? Google it, together with my answer, has gone viral. The only hostile heckling I have experienced was in Oklahoma, where, in an enormous sports stadium, one man stood up in the middle of my speech and started yelling, "You have insulted my saviour!" He was hustled out by uniformed bouncers, not by my wish. That same event at the University of Oklahoma was the only occasion where an attempt was made to prevent me speaking by legal means. State Representative Todd Thompson introduced a bill into the state legislature, of which the following is an extract. When you see a page littered with lots of whereases, you know to brace yourself for trouble. Whereas the University of Oklahoma, as a part of the Darwin 2009 project, has invited as a public speaker on campus Richard Dawkins of Oxford University, whose published opinions, as represented in his 2006 book, The God Delusion, and public statements on the theory of evolution, demonstrate an intolerance for cultural diversity and diversity of thinking and are views that are not shared and are not representative of the thinking of a majority of the citizens of Oklahoma, and whereas the invitation for Richard Dawkins to speak on the campus of the University of Oklahoma on Friday, March 6, 2009, will only serve to present a biased philosophy on the theory of evolution to the exclusion of all other divergent considerations rather than teaching a scientific concept, now, therefore, be it resolved by the House of Representatives of the first session of the 52nd Oklahoma Legislature that the Oklahoma House of Representatives strongly opposes the invitation to speak on the campus of the University of Oklahoma to Richard Dawkins of Oxford University, whose published statements on the theory of evolution and opinion about those who do not believe in the theory are contrary and offensive to the views and opinions of most citizens of Oklahoma. Representative Thompson further alleged that I was paid $30,000 for the lecture and tried to get officials of the university penalised for squandering public money in this way. He ended up with egg on his face because I neither received nor asked for a penny. Moreover, his bill failed to pass. It is truly astonishing that his main objection to my lecturing on evolution was that I held views that are not shared and are not representative of the thinking of a majority of the citizens of Oklahoma. What does Representative Thompson think a university is for? Here's an example of the kind of thing in the God delusion to which I suspect critics take exception, as savage or strident, aggressive or offensive, but which I see as good-natured satire, a touch of the stiletto perhaps, but miles away from the bludgeon or from vulgar abuse. After pointing out that Roman Catholicism, though avowedly monotheistic, has leanings towards polytheism, with the Virgin Mary a goddess in all but name, and the saints attracting personal supplication as demigods, each in his own specialist field of expertise, I continued, Pope John Paul II created more saints than all his predecessors of the past several centuries put together, and he had a special affinity with the Virgin Mary. His polytheistic hankerings were dramatically demonstrated in 1981 when he suffered an assassination attempt in Rome and attributed to his survival to intervention by Our Lady of Fatima. A maternal hand guided the bullet. One cannot help wondering why she didn't guide it to miss him altogether. Others might think the team of surgeons who operated on him for 6 hours deserved at least a share of the credit, but perhaps their hands too were maternally guided. The relevant point is that it wasn't just Our Lady who, in the Pope's opinion, guided the bullet, but specifically Our Lady of Fatima. Presumably Our Lady of Lourdes, Our Lady of Guadalupe, Our Lady of Medjugorje, Our Lady of Akita, Our Lady of Zaytun, Our Lady of Garabandal, and Our Lady of Knock were busy on other errands at the time. Wounding, perhaps, but strident, I don't think so, and certainly not symptomatic of Tourette's syndrome. I think it's legitimate satire, and would like to think quite funny, but it gave grave offence not only to Catholics, but even to the rightly admired Melvin Bragg, a non-religious cultural commentator and enabler who is well on his way to national treasurehood. Such censure arises only, I suspect, because we have taken on board a convention that religion is off-limits to criticism, even to the gentle mockery indulged in the above passage. The point was well put by Douglas Adams in his impromptu speech in Cambridge some years before the God delusion. Religion has certain ideas at the heart of it which we call sacred or holy or whatever. What it means is, here is an idea or a notion that you're not allowed to say anything bad about. You're just not. Why not? Because you're not. If somebody votes for a party that you don't agree with, you're free to argue about it as much as you like. Everybody will have an argument, but nobody feels aggrieved by it. If somebody thinks taxes should go up or down, you're free to have an argument about it. But on the other hand, if somebody says, I mustn't move a light switch on a Saturday, you say, I respect that. Why should it be that it's perfectly legitimate to support the Labour Party or the Conservative Party, Republicans or Democrats, this model of economics versus that, Macintosh instead of Windows? But to have an opinion about how the universe began, about who created the universe, no, that's holy. We're used to not challenging religious ideas, but it's very interesting how much of a furore Richard creates when he does it. Everybody gets absolutely frantic about it, because you're not allowed to say these things. Yet when you look at it rationally, there is no reason why those ideas shouldn't be as open to debate as any other, except that we have agreed somehow between us that they shouldn't be. I emphasise this double standard again in the preface to the paperback edition of The God Delusion, built around the commonly heard weasel phrase, I'm an atheist but. I've already mentioned Salman Rushdie's more recent noticing of the but brigade. I compared the relatively understated language of my book to the savagery we take for granted in theatre criticism, in political commentary, even in restaurant reviews, the most disgusting thing I put in my mouth since I ate earthworms at school. Quite the worst restaurant in London, maybe the world. That notorious passage about the eight Catholic virgin goddesses occurs in Chapter 2 of The God Delusion. It is the long opening sentence of that same chapter that has undoubtedly given the most offence, and even led to charges of anti-Semitism, as I've noted in an earlier chapter. The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. And yet, whether apologists like it or not, every single word of that list is eminently defensible. Examples abound in the Bible. I considered listing them here, but soon realised that the illustrative quotations would fill a book. And my goodness, there's an idea, a book. I know of nobody better qualified to write such a book than my friend Dan Barker. I put it to him, and he jumped at it. Dan used to be a preacher. As I wrote in my foreword to his 2008 book, Godless, How an Evangelical Preacher Became One of America's Leading Atheists, the young Dan Barker was not just a preacher, he was the kind of preacher that you would not want to sit next to on a bus. He was the kind of preacher who would march up to perfect strangers in the street and ask them if they were saved, the kind of doorstepper on whom you might be tempted to set the dogs. Dan knows his Bible as intimately as Charles Darwin knew his beetles and his barnacles, and I'm delighted to say he took my suggestion and is now writing a book devoted to illustrating chapter and merciless verse every word of that opening sentence of my chapter 2 in order. Of course, Christian apologists reply, we all know about the awkward and embarrassing passages in the Old Testament, but what about the New Testament? Whataboutery is a new abstract noun now in the process of entering our language. It has a Wikipedia entry, but has yet to make it into the Oxford English Dictionary. It is most often used to downplay a negative point by diverting attention to something else. Yes, you can find some gently humane wisdom in the teachings of Jesus. The Sermon on the Mount is so good, one wishes more Christians would follow it. But the core myth of the New Testament, for which, to be fair, St. Paul, not Jesus, is to blame, shares the obnoxiousness of the Genesis myth of Abraham's near sacrifice of Isaac, from which it may be derived. I made this point in The God Delusion, and later reprised it in a P.G. Woodhouse parody that I wrote for a Christmas anthology in 2009. I was unfortunately obliged, for copyright reasons, to change the names of Jeeves, Bertie, and the Reverend Aubrey Upjohn, Bertie's headmaster at the school where he had once won a prize for scripture knowledge. All that stuff about dying for our sins, redemption and atonement, Jarvis, all that, and with his stripes we are healed, carry on. Being in a modest way no stranger to stripes administered by old Upcock, I put it to him straight. When I've performed some misdemeanour, or malfeasance, Jarvis? Either might be preferred, sir, depending on the gravity of the offence. So, as I was saying, when I was caught perpetrating some malfeasance or misdemeanour, I expected the swift retribution to land fairly and squarely on the woofter trouser seat, not some other poor sap's innocent derriere, if you get my meaning. Certainly, sir. The principle of the scapegoat has always been of dubious ethical and jurisprudential validity. Modern penal theory casts doubt on the very idea of retribution, even where it is the malefactor himself who is punished. It is correspondingly harder to justify vicarious punishment of an innocent substitute. I am pleased to hear that you receive proper chastisement, sir. Quite, Jarvis. I am so sorry, sir. I did not intend... Enough, Jarvis. This is not dudgeon. Umbrage has not been taken. We woofters know when to move swiftly on. There's more. I hadn't finished my train of thought. Where was I? Your disquisition had just touched upon the injustice of vicarious punishment, sir. Yes, Jarvis, you put it very well. Injustice is right. Injustice hits the coconut with a crack that resounds around the shires, and it gets worse. Now, follow me like a puma here. Jesus was God, am I right? According to the Trinitarian doctrine promulgated by the early church fathers, sir, Jesus was the second person of the triune God. Just as I thought. So God, the same God who made the world and was kitted out with enough nous to dive in and leave Einstein gasping at the shallow end, God, the all-powerful and all-knowing creator of everything that opens and shuts, this paragon above the collarbone, this fount of wisdom and power, couldn't think of a better way to forgive our sins than to turn himself over to the gendarmerie and have himself served up on toast. Jarvis, answer me this. If God wanted to forgive us, why didn't he just forgive us? Why the torture? Whence the whips and scorpions, the nails and the agony? Why not just forgive us? Try that on your Victrola, Jarvis. Really, sir, you surpass yourself. That is most eloquently put. And if I might take the liberty, you could even have gone further. According to many highly esteemed passages of traditional theological writing, the primary sin for which Jesus was atoning was the original sin of Adam. Dash it, Jarvis, you're right. I remember making the point with some vim and élan. In fact, I rather think that may have been what tipped the scales in my favour and handed me the jackpot in that scripture knowledge fixture. But do go on, Jarvis, you interest me strangely. What was Adam's sin? Something pretty fruity, I imagine. Something calculated to shake hell's foundations? Tradition has it that he was apprehended eating an apple, sir. Scrumping! That was it! That was the sin that Jesus had to redeem, or atone according to choice. I've heard of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but a crucifixion for a scrumping? Jarvis, you've been at the cooking sherry. You're not serious, of course. Genesis does not specify the precise species of the purloined comestible, sir, but tradition has long held it to have been an apple. The point is academic, however, since modern science tells us that Adam did not in fact exist and therefore was presumably in no position to sin. Jarvis, this takes the chocolate digestive, not to say the mottled oyster. It was bad enough that Jesus was tortured to atone for the sins of lots of other fellows. It got worse when you told me it was only one other fellow. It got worse still when that one fellow's sin turned out to be nothing more than half-inching a Darcy spice. And now you tell me the blighter never existed in the first place. Jarvis, I'm not known for my size in hats, but even I can see that this is completely doolally. I would not have ventured to use the epithet myself, sir, but there is much in what you say. Perhaps in mitigation I should mention that modern theologians regard the story of Adam and his sin as symbolic rather than literal. Symbolic, Jarvis, symbolic! But the whips weren't symbolic, the nails in the cross weren't symbolic. If, Jarvis, when I was bending over that chair in the Rev. Aubrey's study, I had protested that my misdemeanour, or malfeasance if you prefer, had been merely symbolic, what do you think he would have said? I can readily imagine that a pedagogue of his experience would have treated such a defensive plea with a generous measure of scepticism, sir. Indeed, you are right, Jarvis. Upcock was a tough bimbo. I can still feel the twinges in damp weather. But perhaps I didn't quite skewer the point or nub in re the symbolism. Well, sir, some might consider you a trifle hasty in your judgment. A theologian would probably aver that Adam's symbolic sin was not so very negligible, since what it symbolised was all the sins of mankind, including those yet to be committed. Jarvis, this is pure applesauce, yet to be committed. Let me ask you to cast your mind back yet again to that doom-laden scene in the Beak study. Suppose I'd said, from my vantage point doubled up over the armchair, Headmaster, when you have administered the statutory six of the juiciest, may I respectfully request another six in consideration of all the other misdemeanours or peccadilloes which I may or may not decide to commit at any time into the indefinite future? Oh, and make that all future misdemeanours committed not just by me but by any of my pals. Jarvis, it doesn't add up. It doesn't float the boat or ring the bell. I hope you will not take it as a liberty, sir, if I say that I'm inclined to agree with you. And now, if you will excuse me, sir, I would like to resume decorating the room with holly and mistletoe in preparation for the annual Yuletide festivities. There are good verses as well as nasty ones in both the Old and the New Testaments, but there has to be some criterion for choosing which verses are good and which bad. To avoid circularity, that criterion must come from outside the Scriptures. It is hard to piece together where our dominant criteria for morality come from, but they are clearly exhibited in what I called the shifting moral zeitgeist. We today are 21st-century moralists, unmistakably labelled with 21st-century values. Even the most advanced and progressive thinkers of the 19th century, men like T.H. Huxley, Charles Darwin, and Abraham Lincoln, would appall us with their racism and sexism if they were to enter a modern dinner party or web chat room. Huxley and Lincoln both took the inferiority of black men for granted, and many of the U.S. founding fathers owned slaves. Most of the world's democracies introduced female suffrage as late as the 1920s, France in 1944, Italy in 1946, Greece in 1952, and Switzerland not until a staggering 1971. Justifications for opposing women's suffrage unbelievably included, "It's not necessary because women just vote with their husbands anyway." The moral zeitgeist moves inexorably in one direction, with the result that even the most progressive thinkers of the 19th century tend to lag behind the least progressive thinkers of the 21st. It is by the standards of a civilized 21st century conversation that we cherry-pick the Bible and decide that this verse is bad, but that one good. And since we evidently have preferred and agreed standards for cherry-picking, why bother to go to the Bible at all if we seek moral guidance? Why not go straight to our moral zeitgeist and cut out the scriptural middleman? There are, on the other hand, good reasons to go back to Scripture as literature, because, as I also said in The God Delusion, our whole culture is so bound up with it that you can't take your allusions or understand your history if you're biblically illiterate. Indeed, I filled two pages with close-packed biblical quotations, phrases familiar to everyone but whose scriptural origins are known to few. I am strongly in favour of teaching children about religion, even as I passionately oppose indoctrinating children in the particular religious tradition into which they happen to have been born. I have repeatedly called attention to the strange fact that although we would cringe if we met a phrase like existentialist child or Marxist child or postmodernist child or Keynesian child or monetarist child, a whole society, secular as well as religious, blithely fails to cringe on hearing Catholic child or Muslim child. We need to raise consciousness of the unacceptability of such phrases, exactly as feminists succeeded in raising consciousness about phrases like one man, one vote. Please never speak of a Catholic child or a Protestant child or a Muslim child. Speak instead of a child of Catholic parents or a child of Muslim parents. Alarmist demographic calculations, concluding, for example, that France will have a Muslim majority by the year so-and-so, are entirely based on the gratuitous presumption that children automatically inherit the religion of their parents. That is an assumption that must be fought, not unthinkingly taken for granted. It's a recurrent question, one that has often been put to me since publication of The God Delusion, whether we should be conciliatory and accommodationist when arguing with religious people, or whether to be totally frank. I mentioned this earlier in connection with public questions put to me by Lawrence Krauss and Neil deGrasse Tyson. I suspect that each of the two approaches works well, but with different audiences. I once heard a well-received lecture called Don't Be a Dick, in which the speaker asked the audience for a show of hands. If somebody called you an idiot, would you be more or less likely to be persuaded to their point of view? Needless to say, the vote was overwhelmingly negative. But the speaker should have asked a different question. If you were a third party sitting on the fence, listening to an argument between two people, and one of them gave good reasons to think the other was an idiot, would that bias you in favour of one or the other? I hope I never stoop to gratuitous personal insults, but I do think humorous or satirical ridicule can be an effective weapon. It must hit its target accurately. The American satirical cartoon South Park once included me in a lampoon. It's an instructive illustration because half of it was an accurately targeted satirical touche moment, a future century in which the atheist movement had split schismatically into warring factions, and the other half was not aimed at any target at all and could not be called satire in any sense, a cartoon of me buggering a bald transsexual. If there are passages of the God Delusion which can be read by the sensitive as strongly critical, if not actually strident, the book both ends and begins gently. The last section, entitled The Mother of All Burkas, is an extended metaphor. The life-impoverishing slit in the burqa stands for the narrowness of a pre-scientific worldview, and I go on to illustrate various ways in which the slit can be widened, with consequent enhancement of life and its joys. Science widens it, for example, by showing what a tiny fraction of the electromagnetic spectrum is visible to our senses. The beginning of the book is a generous reminiscence about a chaplain at my old school who, as a boy, was lying with his face in the grass and was inspired, by a moment of revelation, to embrace the religion which was to become his life's path. Suddenly the microforest of the turf seemed to swell and become one with the universe and with the rapt mind of the boy contemplating it. I respected his epiphany enough to say that, in another time and place, that boy could have been me under the stars, dazzled by Orion, Cassiopeia, and Ursa Major, tearful with the unheard music of the Milky Way, heady with the night scents of frangipani and trumpet flowers in an African garden. The reference to Ursa Major was consciously prompted by the memory of a poem written by my mother as a girl, which concluded with the following lines. The great bear stands upon his head, his paws among the apple boughs that, dark against a darker sky, wave in the wind and tap their twigs, with little sounds forlorn and sad, within the night's dark emptiness. My opening page ended with a warmly indulgent reminiscence of how we used to distract our chaplain in divinity lessons by asking him to recall his wartime service in the RAF, and I quoted, in his honour, John Betjeman's gently affectionate poem, Our Padre. Our Padre is an old sky pilot. Severely now they've clipped his wings, but still the flagstaff in the rectory garden points to higher things. After my book was published, I was delighted when an old boy of the same school sent a verse in to my website, richarddawkins.net. I knew your flying chaplain as my housemaster I oughter. While you embraced his liberal views, I just embraced his daughter. Whatever the faults of a British private school education, Oundle must have something going for it if it produces alumni who can turn out that sort of thing. Full circle. I'll end where I began, on my 70th birthday, among 100 guests at the dinner that Lala put on for me in New College Hall. After the choir had sung nostalgic songs, after speeches by Lala herself, by Alan Graffen, my star pupil and later mentor, and by Sir John Boyd, former ambassador to Japan and then master of Churchill College, Cambridge, I made a speech of my own. It culminated in a little poem, verse rather, I don't think I would dignify it as a poem, filled with parodic allusions to E.E. Housman, favourite of my youth, and also of Bill Hamilton, who indeed reminded me of the melancholy protagonist of A Shropshire Lad, to the Book of Psalms, to George and Ira Gershwin, to our national game of cricket, to Shakespeare, G.K. Chesterton, Andrew Marvel, Dylan Thomas, and Keats. Now of my 70 70 won't come again, and take from 70 springs the lot, subtraction tells you what I've got, but only if you're so alarmist as to believe the ancient psalmist. For what is said in Holy Writ, I'm one who doesn't care a bit. Away with actuarial mystics. I'll throw my lot with hard statistics. The Bible may be old and quaint, necessarily so it ain't. I'll go along with George and Ara. Across the reaper's boughs I'll fire a warning shot. I'm not about to let life's umpire give me out, leg before, or caught and bowled, at least until I'm really old, and reach that bourne, the one we learn, from which no travellers return, that decent inn, no Marriott, presaged by time's winged chariot. Still time to gentle that good night, time to set the world alight, time yet new rainbows to unweave, ere going on eternity leave. This is Richard Dawkins. This production of Brief Candle in the Dark, My Life in Science, was recorded at Hats Off Studio, Stonesfield, near Oxford, England, directed by Nicholas Jones, engineered by Michael Taylor. It was produced by Random House UK. Text copyright 2015 by Richard Dawkins. Production copyright 2015 by Random House UK. Published in the US by Harper Audio. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.